Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone. Today, I will be speaking with Barbie Bowles. Barbie is a registered dietitian, certified health coach, and meditation teacher with over 22 years of experience. In her practice, she works as a private coach, community educator, passionate speaker, popular corporate wellness programmer, and respected dietetic intern preceptor. She's had the privilege of counseling thousands of men and women around the country on her journey to better health. Barbie specializes in the unique needs of women over 40. She focuses on helping her clients achieve optimal metabolic and cognitive fitness without the unnecessary and unsustainable rules of fad dieting, and rather through a genuine understanding of what each client truly needs to transform their health for good. Barbie takes an integrative approach that's evidence-based and holistic, emphasizing nourishing foods, quality sleep, daily movement, and developing solid stress skills. She is passionate about a mindful approach to healthy aging and executes a deep knowledge of the psychology and neuroscience behind our behavior surrounding food. In today's episode, we cover so many different topics, including how you can nourish your body to help protect your cognitive health, protein and its role as we age, the importance of whole grains, and so much more. Let's dive in. Just a little disclaimer before we start this episode. This podcast does not provide medical advice. The information on this podcast is for informational purposes only. No material on this site is intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. All right. Hello, everyone. Today here we have Barbie Bowles. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate being here.
So I am excited for our conversation today. As I mentioned to you very briefly before we started, this conversation is kind of near and dear to me. I had a late grandmother that I was very close with who had Alzheimer's very early on. So she didn't really know or get to know my kids. And so protecting my cognitive health and my mother's and just learning more about this is just exciting to me. I'm very excited to talk to you. I would love for you to start off with, though, what made you kind of get into all of this? Like, was there some specific event that sparked your interest, or how'd you get here?
Well, I've always loved food and cooking and nutrition and health. And I have a lot of medical people in my family. So the science kind of appeal was there growing up. I started cooking at the age of 12. So food and its science have kind of always been on my mind, but I didn't go to school for that initially. I went back to school at 27. So this is a kind of a second career for me, nutrition is. And right from the get-go, I noticed in school that there wasn't much of it. Now we're going back, 25 years.
Yeah.
There wasn't much of a differentiation between men and women and nutrition and health and the approach, with the exception, of course, of pregnancy and lactation. And that always really interested me because we are different and we have different needs, both, physically, mentally, and emotionally in our relationships with food. So I always wanted to focus on women. I started a private practice right away. So women has always been my focus. But as I've gotten older, certainly going through the menopause transition, I started to notice that we absolutely have different needs. We'll get into that later if we want to. Mm-hmm. We have different needs. We need to pay more attention to our health during this time. And so I started researching metabolic health specifically. And then that led me down the road of realizing that the health of our brain rests completely on our metabolic health. So we need to make sure we're keeping everything in really good shape in order to protect our brains. And so that's been my focus for some time. But then, much like you, it became personal a few years ago when my mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And mm-hmm. she lives with me and I care for her. And so this is a very, I see this up close. Mm-hmm. And so I became even more passionate about spreading the word to women about all the things that we can do to help protect ourselves.
Yes, yes. I love that. I love when there's this story behind it, because I truly believe that this kind of leads us all down the path where we're kind of meant to go. And I also think it's fascinating that we can have just these many careers throughout our life, and all of them have a role and a place. And yeah, so I love that you're kind of chasing that and really helping to spread the word about this, because it is so, so important. I think we can start off with just talking about, what are the biggest risk factors for developing Alzheimer's and just decline in cognition as we get older?
Sure. So unfortunately, if you have a brain, which we all do, we're all at risk. There are so many potential risk factors for neurodegenerative disease, Alzheimer's, vascular dementia, and then there are other types of dementia that are more rare. But when we're talking about Alzheimer's, which is about 70% of all dementias, and then vascular dementia, which is not far behind, there are lots of things, both in our genes and our environment and our behaviors, that can contribute to risk or help it with prevention. So some of the things, you know, we can get into the genetic aspect of it if you want. I wouldn't get too weedy, but I could just explain. But just to keep it simple, if you prefer, there are a handful of genes that do increase risk. In addition to genetics, things like high blood pressure, both type 1 and type 2 diabetes, obesity, traumatic brain injury, depression, hearing loss, smoking, excessive alcohol consumption, lack of physical activity, lack of cognitive stimulation. So not, you know, kind of retirement and not doing anything.
Exercising your brain. Yeah.
Yeah. Lacking education, unfortunately, and then social isolation, and interestingly, air pollution. But then finally, diet does play a big role. Degree to which it helps, it varies a great deal, because all these other factors matter too. So if you're doing all the things that you need to be doing to protect the health of your brain, then nutrition is going to add, you know, nutrition is going to contribute in a very, very meaningful way. If all of this is a bit messy, unfortunately, nutrition cannot counteract, you know, a completely sedentary lifestyle, excessive alcohol, smoking, you know, diabetes, obesity, et cetera. So that is all to say, it's a very wordy, but that's all to say that, you know, risk is multifactorial. We don't want to get myopic and freaked out about any particular risk. We want to be trying to live our lives in a way that is conducive to better brain health and better metabolic health, because that is the foundation that the health of your brain rests on.
Yes. Now, I've heard a lot about, and I'm sure maybe people listening have heard about this, you know, mind diet and how it can really be beneficial. Can you talk about what that is and just kind of talk about what key foods are in it and what you think about it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a big fan. MIND, M-I-N-D, stands for Mediterranean-Intervention for Neurodegenerative Delay. So this was a team of researchers headed by Dr. Martha Claire Morris at Rush University Chicago. It was published in 2015. So they had been doing research for several years prior. And it was essentially a combination of the Mediterranean philosophy of Mediterranean dietary pattern, on which we have a great deal of research for its benefits. It's consistently rated the most health promoting pattern of eating that we can do. And then it combined it with the DASH diet, which is dietary approaches to stop hypertension, DASH. So that is very little alcohol, if any, and low sodium. So it combined these two methods and then started to tease out foods that are particularly beneficial for brain health. And that included whole grains. So we do not want to avoid whole grains. I know that there's this big push to, you know, all this carb fear and so on. Whole grains consistently across the board are associated with a lower all-cause mortality, so lower risk of all diseases, heart disease, type 2 diabetes, dementia, cancer, and so on. Lots of leafy greens, colorful vegetables. I like to say leafy greens every day and a rainbow throughout the week. Berries, nuts and seeds, beans and lentils, olive oil, fish and seafood. And so you can see very plant forward, but with some fatty fish in there because of the omega-3 fatty acids. And then other foods that weren't necessarily mentioned in the MIND diet, but that I am a big fan of for their anti-inflammatory properties and their disease-fighting properties are cruciferous vegetables, which is broccoli, cauliflower, kale, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, radishes, alliums, which is the onion family, so onion, garlic, shallots, that kind of thing. Dark chocolate, over 70% cacao, avocados, coffee and tea, and then fermented foods. So if we end up talking about gut health at all, I'll mention ferments again. But those are the foods. The other thing about the MIND philosophy that I love so much and the Mediterranean approach is that it's less about exclusion, you know, don't eat this. Mm-hmm. It's more about inclusion. So if you're filling your plate with all of these super nutrient dense goodies, you are doing your brain and body a huge favor. And then of course there's room for the more indulgent kind of fun stuff. But I enjoy the 80-20 rule there. I know it's a cliche, but I think if we followed it, we'd all be doing pretty well to be following something akin to the MIND diet about 80% of the time. And then about 20% of the time, you know, enjoying food as just life's simple pleasures, you know, that's just fun. And then, you know, maybe more 90-10, if the needle is already moving on your metabolic state of health, so if you already have type 2 diabetes or heart disease or mild cognitive impairment, you want to, you know, maybe more 90-10. But is that helpful?
Yes, I actually have multiple statements and questions.
Okay, let's do it.
My hand is raised in the front row.
Okay, cool. I can't see it. Otherwise, I would have let you interrupt me. But yes.
No, you're good. Okay, so before I lose some of these, And I don't know if there's an answer to this at all. The 80-20.
Send you a PDF of this that I wrote so you can like stick it, a link in the show notes.
Oh, yeah, that's perfect. Okay. Yes. Pictures always help. So from a personal level, I have always just kind of indulged in whatever. I would say I, for the most part, was pretty good, like overall, but I would always reach for sweets all day, every day. Mm-hmm. If it's fall, I'm reaching for candy corn all like intermittently all day, but I'll eat well at breakfast, lunch, and dinner, right?
Right.
But the sugar for me has always been a problem. So every once in a while, I'll go 4 to 6 weeks with no processed sugar. So, you know, I'll eat fruit and all of that still, but I won't eat any candy, any ice cream, anything, like not even animal crackers, you know, just like the processed stuff. So that to me has been, it's very difficult at first, but then it becomes very easy. Like I'm on week 4 of my current no sugar Lindsay diet. But it does get easier. Once your body is used to doing something, it actually doesn't crave it anymore. I mean, that's probably pretty obvious. But when it comes to the 80-20, 90-10, does it matter at all, or is it beneficial at all to make that 20% or that 10% either be one day when you're not really caring exactly what you're eating, or if you're doing it like every other day or so, you decide to indulge in something different? Does it matter if it's kind of spread out over time, or if you're taking one day to say, hey, you know what? I'm not going to look at what I'm eating. I'm just going to eat what I want to eat today because I'm, you know, I don't know, going to a festival or whatever. Does it matter how you do that?
In terms of spreading it out versus consecutive days, no, it doesn't matter at all. But to be clear, and this is where a lot of nuance comes in and more the, your, you know, we've got to consider your relationship with food, your health goals, any history of eating disorder, and particularly binge eating disorder, or, you know, tendency towards stress eating or using food as a coping mechanism. We want to be very careful about these behaviors if they can trigger something, you know, dysfunctional or disordered, or if it can just lead you down a path of, okay, I'm just going to do this today, but then it becomes tomorrow also, and then the next day, and then the next day, and then the next day, which is a problem a lot of people have if they restrict too significantly. Mm-hmm. So when I say 80-20, I might even mean 80% of every single day, and then you have a piece of chocolate at night. Or it could be, you could be somebody who, you know, if we split up the year 80-20, we're talking about roughly 295 days and 75 days or roughly, right? So, you know, thinking that you have 75 days a year, and I'm not saying, I don't like the term cheat days or, you know, going hog wild. I mean, days that you just relax and you're not so concerned and you're not going to make yourself sick, but you're also just, you know, you're just enjoying and not thinking too hard about anything. This could be vacation. This could be holidays.
Right.
This could be birthdays. This could be summer barbecue days, whatever. But we to answer your question, it doesn't matter if it's back to back or spread out. It's what's more important is your approach to it. Can you have a day that is just more about fun and then get back to it the day after? I caution people about making it too many consecutive days because then you may get out of your pattern of, you know, eating all these nutrient dense deliciousness foods for too many days in a row. Does that make sense?
No, but totally. Yeah.
I have to be very careful about that because the restrict binge cycle is very real. And if you're restricting too hard for too long, inevitably you will have a binge.
Right.
Or, you know, and so we want to be careful about that. And for that, you just have to know yourself really well. What is the healthiest pattern for you when it comes to the 80-20 philosophy? Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense. Yeah. I mean, if you go away for a week on vacation, you know, the issue with that always is, I mean, you don't have everything accessible to you. You know,
right.
I mean, for the most part, you're cooking at home and you can alter your diet however you'd like. But when you go on vacation, you don't have those options. And so, you know, inevitably, right, you relax and you enjoy yourself on vacation and then you come back and that's always hard. Like you come back and you're like, oh,
right.
I have to go back to preparing everything myself. And, you know, it's an adjustment, you know, and it's definitely, it is harder to eat like this, like how you're mentioning, than it is to just say, hey, you know, whatever is there is what I'm going to eat. Preparing food is always more difficult and it's more costly and it takes a lot of time. And
yeah,
so that needs to be recognized. But
right.
Yeah,
and moms, you know, certainly do not always have the time. What I say, you know, just you mentioned vacation. So I just want to say, I mean, after 25 years of doing this and working with over 1,700 people, mostly women, my approach when it comes to things like vacations or extended periods of time when you know you're not going to be as in control or have access to the things you're normally used to, think less about what you're going to do while you're on vacation and think more about preparing for the week or two after vacation. So when you come back, so put, you know, make a whole bunch of delicious nutrient dense foods like soups or, you know, prepared meals and put them in the freezer. So you've got a week's worth of something when you come back. So you're making that transition just a little bit easier. If you're someone who works out with a personal trainer or has a gym, schedule classes, schedule your sessions. You know what I mean? Like set yourself up for success from right when you get back.
Absolutely. Now you mentioned, so when you said, oh, and I like these additional things, and you mentioned coffee and tea.
Yeah.
And I got excited because I drink a ton of coffee. What do you like most about coffee and tea?
Coffee in particular, actually, very high in antioxidants, liver protective, brain protective, cardio protective. The key about coffee and caffeine really is what we're talking about in terms of what we want to be mindful about is ideally no more than 400 milligrams of caffeine in a day and no more than 200 milligrams in a sitting. And perhaps even less if you're someone who is genetically caffeine sensitive. And if you are, you would know that, you know, a cup of coffee would make you jittery. There are some people who can literally drink coffee all day and not feel jittery at all. That doesn't mean it's not having an impact on you. So, and your sleep quality in particular, because caffeine stays in your system for many, many hours. So really, coffee and tea are fantastic sources of antioxidants. In fact, coffee is where most Americans get most of their antioxidants, which is probably not a great thing. But it's the truth. But yeah, have your coffee and tea. Absolutely. Just be mindful about that caffeine content.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm totally the person that, I mean, working in the emergency department, obviously we kind of drink coffee any hour of the day, but yeah, I could drink coffee well into dinner time and still go to bed at like 10 o'clock with no issue at all. And I'm usually probably under 300, sometimes under 200 a day. I don't.
Oh, well crazy. Then.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know, I have one in the morning. I usually start off with something before the workout and then I have another, like I'm sipping on my coffee now, but I sip my coffee. I'm an all day drinker for coffee. My husband, it drives him crazy. He's like, what is wrong with you? He gulps his down. It's crazy to me. I'll be like, here, I made it. Cause we put protein in our coffee. So we make these coffees every morning and I hand it over and like in 10 minutes it's gone. I'm like, what? did you just drink all of that? Like, who does that? Like, what a crazy thing to do.
Oh, that's funny.
And I'm the person who just drinks it for like 6 hours at a time.
Right. Oh,
yeah. So
yeah, I'm a giant coffee fan. And by the way, decaf has the same antioxidant benefits. Mm-hmm. So if you're someone who doesn't tolerate caffeine, but you enjoy coffee and you want the antioxidant benefits, decaf is fine too.
Yes. Okay. And the other question I had was, I had recently read a study about whole grains and just how incredibly amazing and beneficial they are. So
yeah.
I'd love to hear from you what are the best sources of whole grains that we can kind of fill our homes with?
Mm-hmm. So oats are particularly beneficial they really have a strong association for being helpful with cholesterol, lowering LDL cholesterol and ApoB. So I would say oats probably at the top of the list. Quinoa is great because it's a complete protein, meaning that it has ample amounts of all 9 essential amino acids that our body needs to get from food. To be clear, all plant foods have all 9 essential amino acids. Just because they're incomplete proteins doesn't mean they're missing an amino acid. It just means they don't have enough in ample amounts of, you know, a handful of amino acids. This is why combining things like beans, which are technically incomplete, and rice, which is technically incomplete, but when you put them together, they form a complete protein. Mm. But quinoa is complete all by itself. Buckwheat, amaranth, these are really good grains to have as a source of protein. But rice, and by the way, the difference between white rice and brown rice, nutritionally speaking, is not huge. So if you like white rice, go right ahead.
Yeah.
So
I feel like that was a thing for a while. It was like, don't touch the white rice. Don't touch it. Only eat the brown rice. There's like these fads that go in and out, and I'm sure that you know all about them. But it's like, and especially, you know, on social media, people will just scream from the rooftop something that is just completely untrue when it comes to, you know, what particular food.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, if somebody is standing in a grocery store, just swipe on by. Yeah. Because there is a very solid chance that they're picking things off the shelves and talking about toxins and just being ridiculous. So let's not take nutrition advice from people who are standing in grocery stores, especially if they don't have a shirt on.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I can think of a couple of accounts that I, you know, years ago would stumble across. And I actually had a really, really amazing. Have you heard of, oh gosh, was her handle Food Science Babe or something?
Oh, she's a food pen.
Okay. Yeah. Love her.
Wonderful.
Love her. I had her on the podcast a couple years ago, and she just basically debunked all of the like non-GMO, organic, all that stuff. And she was like, listen. And it was just great because I had some people that listened to that, and they, you know, as a mom, you go into the grocery store and you want to feed your children the best things, right? Obviously, like that's what we want to do, but that is not achievable for everybody. And it's so dangerous to say that something that costs 3 times as much is just way healthier for your kids than something that costs 3 times less. Like that can be so damaging. And then if you can't afford it, you feel like guilt and shame and all those things. So it's so damaging.
It's wrong on so many levels. And if you notice these people who do this, they tend to go after affordable foods that people commonly eat because that's what gets attention. If they're talking about, you know, I don't know, sea moss from Erewhon, barely anybody eats that. So nobody's going to listen to that. If you're talking about oatmeal, people are going to listen because so many people eat oatmeal or some version of it. So that's why they go after these foods. It has absolutely nothing to do with science or having your health in mind. So just be careful out there.
Yeah. Be careful out there. Okay. So back to the MIND diet. So what are the ways in which you kind of incorporate and alter this to create your daily diet? Like, what does it kind of look like in real time?
Sure. So I'm very fortunate in the sense that I grew up eating these foods. So I love these foods. Sometimes this is a huge shift for people. And I am very sensitive to that and have a lot of empathy when trying to incorporate these foods. It's slow going, but stick with it. Because if you just add, say, a serving of leafy greens a day for a week, you know, then the next week, add some berries. The next week, add some colorful vegetables. So go slow with this is all new to you. But I generally start the day with an egg white omelet filled with veggies. I do avoid egg yolks because I need to be very careful about my LDL cholesterol and ApoB. I have a genetic situation that requires me to be very careful. So an egg white omelet with veggies and then a big bowl of fruit and a handful of almonds is kind of what I start my day with after my workout. Mm-hmm. Midday, I have a giant salad. I have what I call the weekly chop. And if you follow me on Instagram, you will see this in my stories pretty much every week. And this is just about, I aim for 12 to 15 different plants in each weekly chop. So a bunch of different kinds of herbs, greens, veggies, sometimes nuts or seeds. And then dinner is usually some kind of protein and some kind of vegetable. So I eat chicken, fish, and egg whites and tofu and edamame as my main sources of protein. And then I try to add crucifers and alliums at dinner. And then there usually is some avocado in there and some fermented food. I love kimchi. Kimchi is my favorite. Fermented food. I also love raw sauerkraut. So that's pretty much what my day looks like with coffee.
Don't forget the coffee.
Don't forget the coffee.
I had not even touched kimchi until, oh my gosh, I was doing one of those, I don't know, one of those, you know, meal subscriptions and a lot of their meals. Oh, purple carrot. That was the one. It's like all plant-based. So during COVID, medical providers received like 30 or 40% off or something. And I was like, ooh, let's try this. And there was a lot of kimchi. And I actually learned a lot more of like how to just cook with just so many different plants. Like I kind of grew up in a traditional, like we always had meals that were hearty in beef and chicken and all of those things. And so it was kind of interesting to kind of veer off into that. I found it fascinating. So I did want to ask you, when it comes to, you said that you were kind of raised eating this way, which I think is awesome and fascinating. How would you approach raising your children to eat similarly without creating too much fixation on, you know, eating quote unquote healthy? Like, what would your approach be with your kids to kind of grow up this similarly to how you did?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And if you could see me, you could see that I'm smiling huge because my children do not eat this way. I have two children. I have a almost 21-year-old and 16-year-old. And I mean, they do fine, but by no means do they follow this pattern. That said, my 21-year-old is starting to become more interested in nutrition and fitting in foods that he knows are going to be beneficial for him in the long run. Mm-hmm. So that's great. My 16-year-old just kind of does his thing. And, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, I'll make things like tacos and I'll shove as many veggies in there as I possibly can. That's what I try to do with him mm-hmm. and my older child. But, you know, here's the thing. When it comes to children, and again, this could be its own episode, the best thing you can do is to provide the foods that you want to encourage your child to eat. But don't be pushy about it. Mm-hmm. This is what you put on the table for yourself and your family. And hopefully they will learn to enjoy it, especially if they're starting out that way. But, you know, being a picky eater is a very real thing. And it can be very difficult to overcome. But the worst thing you can do is force it or make mealtime stressful.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely.
The other thing about the difference between the way I'm raising my children or just raising children right now and versus the 70s and early 80s when I was growing up, there, of course, there were hyper palatable, ultra processed foods available. I mean, I ate my Twinkies and drank my Diet Coke for sure.
Absolutely.
But it wasn't as abundant and available 24/7 the way that it is now. Mm-hmm. So the landscape of food is not conducive to a super healthy eating pattern. So we have to work a little harder to get it done in this environment. Mm-hmm. So what I would say to parents is just you bring in the food that you want. You're buying the food, you're making the choices, and you're putting on the table what you want to put on the table. And here's the other thing, you got to eat it too, because you have to model that behavior. And then, you know, when it comes to like snacks, just so the pantry isn't crazy overflowing, one of the, you know, pieces of advice that I give, let's say you have two kids and two adults in the house, you know, you pick, say, four snacks that are going to be available in the pantry for 1 week. And then you don't, no more, like you just shop the one time and you fill the pantry with the four snacks and that's it. And if it gets eaten within 3 days, it gets eaten. You know, and then we're not shopping until the next week. Mm-hmm. So you just kind of have to deal. And that helps to teach children to sort of ration a bit. And ration is probably the wrong term because that's kind of restrictive sounding. But, you know, I mean, to just be reasonable about how much they're going to eat. And that's something that each person has to work out within their family.
Right.
But the big thing about if you want your children to eat well is to provide the food, you know, and make it appealing and try not to make it stressful.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Mosh. We've all heard the old adage, you are what you eat. And in our fast-paced modern lives, that rings truer than ever. I'm always on the lookout for a delicious and satisfying protein-packed snack that I can grab on the go. Well, I've found one that not only fuels my body, but helps me live more intentionally too. Mosh bars. Mosh collaborated with the world's top scientists and functional nutritionists to create these bars that I think are better than many of the protein snacks I've tried in the past. Mosh bars come in six insanely tasty flavors, and each one packs 12 grams of high-quality protein, plus brain-boosting ingredients like ashwagandha, collagen peptides, and omega-3s. As a busy mom juggling family life with my career, I've woven Mosh bars into my daily routine. I'll have one mid-morning to power through until lunch without hitting that energy slump, or I'll stash one in my bag for post-workout fuel on the go. The great flavors and functional ingredients leave me feeling satisfied and focused. My two favorite flavors are the banana bread and the peanut butter chocolate crunch. If you want to find ways to give back to others and fuel your body and your brain, Mosh bars are the perfect choice for you. Head to moshlife.com/Lindsay, that's L-Y-N-Z-Y, to save 20% off plus free shipping on either the best sellers trial pack or the new plant-based trial pack. That's 20% off plus free shipping on either the best sellers or plant-based trial pack at moshlife.com/Lindsay, L-Y-N-Z-Y. Thank you, Mosh, for sponsoring this episode.
So I will say feeding children is like one of the most difficult things. And we have one out of four that for some reason, I don't know, she'll eat anything. Like I could put in front of her all of the things that you have mentioned today and she would eat all of them. And I didn't do anything different with her. Okay. So I don't think that this is parent driven. I think this is truly just like, this is me and I don't want to eat that. Like, so, you know, I wouldn't, as a parent, I feel like there's so much we have to worry about. Right. Oh, yeah. And I feel like when it comes to eating, like, let's just let that one go, you know?
I couldn't agree with you more. Yeah. I mean, and again, because I, like I said, the stressful environment around food is what's even more problematic than say having Doritos for dinner. Right. Do you know what I mean? So, and you know, they will turn out fine as long as they're meeting their milestones. They have energy, they're sleeping well, they're doing okay in school. They're, you know, they're developing the way that they should, you know, ideally develop. It's okay. Mm-hmm. As long as they're getting enough calories and ideally, you know, enough protein and hydration, don't worry about it so much.
Yeah. I have started to kind of implement, and again, I try to be careful about this because I don't want them thinking too much about it, especially, you know, I'm only just starting to talk to my oldest about this, but she has to leave the house pretty early to make the bus with our neighbor. And so she will get up on her own because usually I'm working out. And so she'll get up, she'll come downstairs and, you know, this morning she leaves a mess. We're working on that, but that's kind of annoying. But she'll make her own eggs because, you know, we're like, okay, how are you fueling your body for the day? And we try to teach her, you know, what foods, you know, are high in protein and what's going to keep you feeling full until the next time you right. have a snack or you have your lunch. And we try to teach them those things so that eventually as they get older, they're like, okay, if I have a soccer game in 3 hours from now, how do I want to fuel my body so that I can run faster or run, you know, to be able to perform the activities that I have to perform? And so that's kind of what we talk about. And we try to just model that. So, we're working out and then afterwards I'm like, I'll talk to myself and be like, okay, I'm going to make myself an omelet. I'm going to put a lot of veggies in it. And it just worked out. And I want to replenish and I want to make sure I'm eating a lot of protein and kind of just doing that. I feel like just kind of talking it through, even if you're just talking to yourself, your kids are listening and present for that. So that's kind of what we've incorporated.
Yeah. I love that approach and, keeping it very relevant to that day, I mean, having energy for homework or activities or, how they're going to feel is really smart. And, just basically trying to keep the language around it extremely positive and not talking about calories or weight loss or, this is good or bad or polka dotted. It just is. It's, whether it's pure pleasure fuel or nutrient dense fuel, it's just food. And to keep the language really neutral is what's most important.
Yeah, absolutely. The last thing about that particular part I wanted to ask you about was for someone that works out in the morning, and this is more just like almost more of a personalized question.
Yeah.
For people that work out in the morning, what I have found for myself is that I want to get up and I just work out usually fasted. Now, I used to think this was all fine and good. Until recently, when I have actually been trying to do more of, I guess you could call it bulking, but just like trying to gain more muscle. I mean, obviously, as we age, we lose muscle mass. And so this is something I'm really trying to protect and really trying to build muscle. So I've tried to increase, consumption. And by doing that, I have learned that perhaps it might be more beneficial to have something before the workout in order to fuel my body more like halfway through, because halfway through your body's like searching for what it's going to use for energy. Is that kind of correct or?
Yeah, it's very individualized. For fat loss, muscle gain is something a little different, but for fat loss, so if somebody is on a fat loss journey, whether we work out fasted or fed makes absolutely no difference. The net effect on fat loss is the same. So really it's whatever feels good to you. Some people feel better to have a bowl of berries and water or a smoothie or even a full breakfast before working out. Pay attention to how your body feels and how your body performs. If gaining significant muscle mass is the goal, it probably is better to fuel a little bit beforehand so that you your body has more energy to work with, already right there. Something else that is beneficial is, and I'm very, very conservative with supplementation. I don't usually recommend it unless I see a gap in your diet, or I know that you're, have a deficiency, say B12 or vitamin D or omega-3s. But I do really, I've really come around on creatine.
Oh yeah. I just started doing that like 3 weeks ago because I read so much of the research on this and it is hugely beneficial.
Yeah. So if and it doesn't matter if you take that before or after. In fact, there is some suggestion that taking it like afterwards, because your muscles are more receptive to it, might be beneficial. But honestly, it doesn't matter. Whatever works for you. But the key thing is make sure you're hydrated, if nothing else.
Yeah.
But I find for most of my clients who tend to be women in their 40s and 50s, having a little something like a bowl of fruit and a big glass of water before a workout, you just have more energy and you perform better.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been doing, it's just eat quick. I just do a banana and I cut it down the middle and throw a little bit of some peanut butter in there.
Yeah.
And that seems to kind of like hit the spot. And I mean, it's hard when you don't feel hungry. You wake up and you're like, oh, the last thing I want to do is like ingest something. And it has to be light because you can't go work out. I mean, I can't anyways on a full, if I were to do like, I like Dave Killer's Killer Bagels. But to have one of those before a workout, I'm like, oh gosh, that feels so heavy. Like I don't think.
Yeah. And I mean, digestion is a major process that you ask your body to perform. And so is exercise. And so is sleep. This is why we don't want to eat too close to bedtime. It has nothing to do with intermittent fasting. But, sleep is a process that you are asking your body to perform. It's not passive by any means. And if we're trying to digest and either exercise or sleep at the same time, we're not going to do any of it well.
Yeah.
So keeping the heavy lifting, especially of digestion, which requires about 2 to 3 hours, separate from a strenuous workout or sleep is really probably the way to go for most.
Yeah, makes sense. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about entering into that like premenopausal, menopausal phase of our life and how we can use our nutrition to help balance out our hormones and what's going on within our bodies during that time.
Okay, sure. So, you know, for most women, the age of the full transition to being postmenopausal is around 51, and postmenopausal meaning you've had a full year with no menstrual period. And for most women, the average menopause transition, what we still sometimes call perimenopause, is usually 4 to 6 years. So usually by the time a woman is 45, this process is starting. Estrogen and progesterone are starting to become erratic. It isn't this nice, slow, steady slope that just kind of trails off into the ether with menopause. It's a lot of up and down, which is why we can have a lot of these strange symptoms like hot flashes, poor sleep, cognitive problems, mood swings, and various other things. So there isn't any diet or eating pattern or food that, quote, balances hormones. That's a lot of hyperbole and somebody's trying to sell you something. But if we nourish our bodies well with the vitamins and minerals and phytonutrients and protein, carbs and fat and hydration, and we eat in a pattern that keeps our blood sugar relatively stable, so we're not skipping breakfast and lunch and eating all of our calories in the evening, but we're eating a nice morning meal, a nice midday meal, perhaps ideally kind of a dinner on the early-ish side, so we've got a few hours to digest before we go to sleep. That's going to keep things in nice alignment with our circadian rhythm. It's going to keep our blood sugar in better balance. It's going to take advantage of improved insulin sensitivity in the morning, because human beings are more insulin sensitive in the morning hours. So it's better to try to get, and again, I don't want this to sound like a rule, but it's just a suggestion to try to get kind of 2/3 of your calories in by say 2-3 p.m. Again, this is about taking advantage of the insulin sensitivity mm-hmm. that occurs earlier in the day. But eating kind of in alignment with the Mediterranean, the DASH, the MIND diet. So those are all the foods that we know to be super beneficial. And then eating in a pattern that's going to keep you satisfied and your mood stable and your blood sugar stable and help you sleep well is generally the best. To be well nourished is going to help support healthy hormone production. But there is no such thing as a diet that, quote, balances hormones. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's another thing I'm sure I have at least seen it on social media in the past where, you know, it's almost like they kind of prey on those that, you know, are struggling. So, you know, people that struggle with infertility and, oh, it's because, you know, during this phase of your cycle, you're supposed to be eating X, Y, and Z. And, oh, here's my, you know, specific nutrition plan and you can buy it for $30 or whatever. You
know? Yeah. If anyone is making nutrition sound complicated, they are trying to sell you something or they don't know what they're talking about. Because honestly, the best nutrition approaches are stuff you've been hearing probably since you were a child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Eat some veggies.
Yeah.
Stay hydrated, get enough protein, you know, eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I mean, these are the low-hanging fruit is truly mm-hmm. the best advice when it comes to nutrition.
Yeah. Now, you've mentioned fasting a couple of times. Is there any you hear about this all the time, like, oh, you know, I'm currently in my fasting phase, like I'm fasting right now. And Right. Is there any benefit that you've uncovered to doing certain types of fasting?
So this is a very nuanced topic mm-hmm. too. But what I will say in general for the average healthy person, there are a couple of different aspects to this. When it comes to fat loss, which is the reason most people start intermittent fasting. When it comes to fat loss, there is zero difference between intermittent fasting and just restricting calories across the board and eating in a 12-hour window. So all you're really doing if you're losing weight on with an intermittent fasting protocol is eliminating calories. So you're eliminating an mm-hmm. entire meal. So there's no difference in terms of fat loss. When it comes to other potential benefits like improved insulin sensitivity, autophagy, better sleep, just better metabolic function in general, we're just not there with human data. But there are a lot of really passionate proponents of intermittent fasting that will make it sound like we're there, but we quite frankly aren't. I'm not saying that it does, that the benefits aren't there. I'm saying I have not seen research that is so strongly compelling for that I can say, yes, everybody should try this.
Yes. Yeah.
And certainly if you have a history of eating disorder or any your relationship with food is at all influenced by, you know, restricting, it's not a good idea for you. Mm-hmm. That said, digestive rest is important. So I like to advocate for, say, a 10-hour window, no more than 12. We shouldn't, you know, the average American eats in a 14 to 15-hour window. That's too much time spent eating and digesting for our bodies. Because, you know, when we're not eating, when we're in a fasted state, it is true that our body is able to do other things more efficiently, including digestive tract repair. So not eating 24/7 is a good idea, but you certainly don't have to restrict down to an 8 or 4 hour window. Or what I really don't like is alternate days, like, you know, 500 calories a day, 3 days a week. You know, I'm not a fan of at all. But I like, you know, a 10-hour window, no more than 12.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yep. And then I have all these questions mapped out, but then I was like, and now I'm just kind of veering off in so many directions.
No, I hope you don't mind.
And
if you want to take a second to collect, because I know how that goes, you know, you get into conversation and then the outline goes out the window. Yeah. So
we're touching on things, but
it'd be fine if you'd like to regroup.
Yeah, it's just these are questions that I know, you know, just like trying to navigate things as you, you know, enter into farther down in motherhood, you start focusing more back on yourself, which is kind of where I'm at. And it's just fascinating to kind of learn more about all of these things. So I've read so many different things about protein. I was absolutely in the dark about how much to eat in a day prior to having all my children. I just never made it a priority. And, you know, once I had my fourth, I, you know, was like, where did my buck go? Where did it go? It fell off. It actually fell off. It's gone. So I was like, okay, you know, that was the thing that kind of made me think, all right, like maybe I need to be focusing more on my protein and I don't have any energy. And I just, you know, so many different things. So I try to get in basically 1 gram per pound of weight just to kind of be, you know, just more generalized is what I personally try to do. And then what I've read and kind of understand is that once you kind of hit that, if you're eating more than that, it's not necessarily beneficial. It kind of is whatever at that point. Is that kind of true?
Yeah, it's even more individualized than that. Honestly, what research tells us is that between 1.2 and 1.6 grams per kilogram. So max end of that is probably 0.75 grams per pound is probably where muscle protein synthesis taps out. Mm-hmm. So if you're eating a gram per pound, you're still going to use that protein for other functions besides muscle protein synthesis. Mm-hmm. Protein has more than just muscle building function in the body. Mm-hmm. However, if you are going in excess of your calorie needs, whether it's protein, fat, or carbohydrate, that's going to be stored as fat. So what I always say is we know that the RDA of 0.8 grams per kilogram is way too low. What's healthy for most adults is between 1.2 and 1.6 grams per kilogram. Higher end if you're someone who strength trains, and quite frankly, all women as early as possible should be strength training, but at the very latest, by the time you get into your 40s, because we start to lose muscle mass, as you alluded to, around between the ages of 30 and 35, the loss of that muscle mass and strength accelerates significantly with the decline in estrogen. And the decline in estrogen also makes it more difficult to regain. So as early as you possibly can, get enough protein and strength train. But I would say for the average person, 1.6 grams per kilogram is probably going to meet their needs, both for muscle protein synthesis and other protein functions. Mm-hmm. And the thing you have to be careful about is if somebody has, you know, fat to lose in order to improve their metabolic health, you want to base that on your ideal body weight, not the weight
you are.
If not your current weight, if fat loss is appropriate. And let's say you have a very significant amount of fat that you'd like to lose, say in excess of 30 or 40 pounds, you kind of want to split the difference initially so that you're not under eating. Does that make sense?
Yes. No, it absolutely makes sense.
Okay.
And but then
again, this is experimentation. So if, if a gram per pound is working for you, it's working for you.
Yeah.
I don't make that blanket recommendation for everyone.
Well, and you know, I love how you're saying that everything is so personalized because I mean, obviously you know that, but it really, really is because, and I'll kind of share this. Do you have, I want to make sure that we're not going to, if we go over like 5 or 10 minutes, are you okay?
No, I'm completely fine.
Okay. So I'll kind of share this. So, you know, on this journey over the past 3 to 4 weeks, I'm really concentrating on building muscle, right? And so I've been, you know, lifting for a couple of years now, but I'm really trying to focus on bulking more than anything. And so I have tried to, I'm trying to track macros, and I've been doing that now for 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And I'm doing it based off of what I would, it's more for a weight gain type of situation. Mm-hmm. So, and I have this cool body scanner at the gym that I'm at that'll tell you, you know, if you're gaining your weight in muscle versus fat type of thing. Mm-hmm. So it can be very helpful. However, I'll share why I'm frustrated. So I've been tracking these macros and I have been overshooting protein. I tend to eat the same exact things every day. It's just easier for me, you know, eating the same things every day mm-hmm. that help boost my protein. And so I've been overshooting that. But the caloric, overall caloric intake is where it needs to be in order for me to aim for, you know, weight gain.
Okay.
However, after 3 weeks, I actually lost 1.5 pounds, which again, that was not my goal. My goal was to gain weight. Lost 1.5 pounds and then it's, and you know, this is a machine. So who knows, you know, it really, I'm going by how I feel. And that's the takeaway here is, you know, how you feel is most important. But I lost 4 pounds of muscle, gained 3 pounds of fat. And then that 1.5 pounds, you know, like was that net loss. And so I'm looking at it and I'm like scratching my head because I'm like, I have never been more just aware of how I'm fueling my body and how is it resulting in this? And so then I'm trying to figure out, okay. And so one of the changes I made this particular week, and like everybody's body is different, right? Your body is going to react differently. So I'm like, okay, so let me figure this out. And so that's when I started to add in food before a workout, because I'm like, maybe my body is not being fueled enough before the workout. And it's, you know, might be using muscle or whatever it is for energy. So I'm like, maybe we'll start there, add something into the morning. And then just slightly increasing that overall calorie, because it seems to me that there must still be a net loss of calories at the end of the day, right? I mean,
yeah, there could be. Also, you know, it's tricky because three weeks is not a long period of time. And I seriously, and we're talking about like an in-body scale, right? Like bioelectrical impedance scale. Yep. So, you know, the accuracy of those is imperfect. Mm-hmm. When we're talking about anything between 1 pound and 3 pounds, a lot of that could be fluid.
Right.
I seriously doubt that you lost 4 pounds of muscle and gained 3 pounds.
Right. It doesn't even seem that it was like, that's like, I was like, that's a wild thing.
Yeah. I wouldn't, to be honest with you, if you feel good, I would not worry about that data. I would just keep up your efforts, keep doing mm-hmm. what you're doing as long as you feel good. And retest in say, I don't think you should do those more than every 3 months.
Right. I know it takes a very, very long time to see muscle growth in general. Right. So I totally get that. And so I think, you know, we're doing this like little, I wouldn't call it a competition. Yeah. It's like a little challenge and it's to gain muscle, lose fat type of thing. And so, you know, it's been fascinating to kind of learn these things, but I agree. I don't think it's helpful though, to be looking at those numbers so early on because you know, then you start to like second guess, like, what am I doing?
Yeah.
But it takes a long time.
And I mean, yeah, that is confusing data. I will acknowledge. And I don't think you should pay any attention to it.
Yeah.
I think if you're enjoying what you're doing and you're feeling good, keep going and don't do that test more than every 3 months.
Yeah, I like that advice. But like I said, you know, it's funny because you could be standing next to, you know, two of your friends and you guys could all be doing the same exact thing, nutrition-wise and exercise-wise, and every single body is going to respond differently to it. So,
and that's such an important point because we do tend to compare ourselves either to people we know personally or people online, which is even worse. And what we have to realize is each person is bringing their own set of genes and metabolic function to the party, and no two people are going to react the same way to the same plan.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So I'm going to, my last question about this topic for you is going to be what your favorite go-to quick bites to eat are, because I feel like, you know, as a mom, you're like pulled in 50 different directions. So I'd love to hear like what your go-to snacks are.
Are we talking about snacks?
Yeah.
Or are we talking about meals? Oh, snacks. Okay. I have the same two. Like you, I tend to eat very similarly, like most days. And I find that's easy. Mm-hmm. I take the pressure off. We're good to go with, you know, it's easy to prep. But I have two snacks that I go to all the time. One is either a bowl of berries and a handful of nuts. So usually it's like raspberries, blackberries, or strawberries and almonds. Or colorful veggies, so like peppers, carrots, celery, cucumbers, and hummus that I make. I have a couple different hummus recipes.
Ooh, really, can you send me those? Are they like working out? Ooh, love that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so is there anything else that you wanted to incorporate into this before we end with these two quick questions I have for you that are unrelated?
No, you mean you have two more questions?
Yes, but they're unrelated to the topic. They're just fun ones.
Oh, okay. You know, yeah, I would just say in addition to nutrition. So, you know, what we're talking about with nutrition is, and I cannot stress this enough, get enough protein and strength train, ladies, because by the time you get into your 40s and 50s, it becomes more difficult. And muscle mass and strength are truly the keys to longevity. Mm-hmm. They are what keep us thriving. And then just in terms of your health, the health of your brain, having nothing to do with nutrition and exercise, because those are the things that we can, you know, there's information about that everywhere. What we don't talk about enough is something called cognitive reserve. And this is something that is going to keep your brain thriving, that has nothing to do with what you eat or how you move. This is about continuing for the rest of your life to continue to learn new information and use it. So stimulate your brain every opportunity you get. Obviously, we want to rest and we want downtime and we want no stress time too. But to stress your brain in a positive way, to continue to learn new information, is incredibly important to the long-term health of your brain and reducing your risk of neurodegenerative disease.
Yes. So you can learn more by listening to the podcast. That's a great little...
Yes.
I love that. Okay. So ending with two questions. So the first question I have for you, completely unrelated to what we talked about today, is if you could give one piece of advice to mothers, what would it be?
To mothers, oh gosh, enjoy this time. It goes so fast. No matter how stressful it is, just find a really healthy stress outlet like meditation or breath work or taking a walk. But cherish this time, because once they are a little older, it's a lot less, you just get a lot less time with them. Mm-hmm. So just enjoy it. Enjoy this time. Mm-hmm. Really.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because, you know, you hear that and it's crazy to think like in 8 years, our oldest, she's just gone. Like, how is it that you spend every waking second with these kids and then they're just gone?
I
still will never kind of get used to that, just the thought of that. I think it's wild, you know?
It is. And I mean, also just don't take it all so seriously. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, because most things, obviously there are exceptions, you know, really significant, serious issues aside, most things that bug you on a daily basis, in 5 years, you're going to look back and either not remember or laugh at it. Mm-hmm. So just, you know, relax, and you don't have to be perfect. Mm-hmm. Not everything has to be perfect all the time.
Yes, yes. Okay, so last question. If you could make one meal for your family that everyone would eat, that's relatively quick and easy, what would it be?
Oh, tacos.
Yes. That's such a common response. I love that. How do you make your tacos?
All this, you can hide good stuff in tacos too.
Yes. I love it. A taco bar is always great with little kids too, because they like to put everything on it.
100%.
Mm-hmm. Yes. All right. Well, thank you so much. I am so happy that you took the time out of your schedule to talk with us today, Barbie. This was absolutely amazing. And thank you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for hanging out with us today. All resources mentioned in this episode can be found in the show notes on lindsayandco.com. To continue these important conversations, head over to Motherhood Meets Medicine on Instagram. Let me know what you learned from this episode and who you would love to hear from next. I always love getting feedback from you. If you're finding value in this podcast, please rate, review, subscribe, and share with a friend. This will help us to reach even more women from around the world. I'll catch you next week. Until then, don't forget to find some time to unplug, unwind, and have a little fun.